Now on Documentary on News Talk, producer Pavel Barter explores the props, architecture and designs behind three Irish films, Ryan's Daughter, Rawhead Rex and The Van, in Propped Up.
Ah. Rose Videos, how can I help you?
Hello, I'm looking for three Irish films in which the props, architecture and design tell a story, behind the scenes as well as on the screen.
Props or designs?
Yeah, like the lightsaber in Star Wars or the space station in Kubrick's 2001.
Or the horse's head in The Godfather.
Yeah, exactly.
But in Irish films?
Right, ones where the designs aren't just in the background. They tell a story of their own.
Ah, yeah. Well, let's have a look now. Ah, yeah. Here we go. Ryan's Daughter. They built the entire village from scratch, you know. Knocked it down after filming. One building still stands in West Kerry.
I'm on the Dingle Peninsula in West Kerry, on a cliff overlooking the Atlantic Ocean.
And there's a haunted house right there.
It's basically just a house with loads of bricks around it and the top is ripped off.
And what does that sign up there say?
Karari National School, 1893.
Well, what if I told you it was actually built for a very famous movie?
What?
Do you think this looks like a film set?
No, it looks like a school. And why does...
It's like a haunted house.
I know why it's called the schoolhouse. Because it was a prop in the movie.
Yeah.
So I'm literally standing on where a famous person stood.
Yeah, David Lean.
Who's David Lean?
David Lean is recognised as one of the most important directors in motion picture history.
For best achievement in directing, David Lean, Lawrence of Arabia.
The award for the best motion picture.
The Bridge on the River Kwai, David Lean.
Ladies and gentlemen, this Life Achievement Award belongs to Sir David Lean.
And in the late 1960s, he decided to bring an epic story of love, war and betrayal to the Dingle Peninsula.
What is it called?
It's called Ryan's Daughter.
Oh, Ryan! I know him.
I don't know if it's the same Ryan. Ryan's Daughter tells the story of Rosie Ryan, an Irish woman, played by Sarah Miles, who marries the school teacher, played by Robert Mitchum, then has an affair with a British officer. It's set in 1917.
I live at the schoolhouse.
Schoolhouse?
I'm married to the teacher.
I want to find out more about this schoolhouse, so I begin by meeting T.P. O'Connor, who owns the campsite a few miles north of Dingle.
That's Ben Kingsley. He stayed here as well in the campsite.
Ben Kingsley?
Ben
yeah,
Kingsley.
Yeah.
Come on.
They did, what do you call it?
Gandhi.
Gandhi.
Yeah.
And that's Sarah Miles there.
That's Sarah Miles, yeah.
She was younger then, he wouldn't know her at all now.
TP looks the same.
He hasn't changed one bit.
He hasn't. TP was the transport manager's assistant on Ryan's Daughter.
And this is Sarah Miles and Robert Mitchum.
Are they in the schoolhouse there?
They're in the schoolhouse there.
During the winter of 1968 to 1969, Lean's crew began constructing a village from scratch for the film on the side of a mountain above Dunquin. And what was the quality of the construction up there?
Oh, perfect. I mean, the pub, the shop, the barracks, all that was all completely done. I mean, you could live in those houses. It was a very cold winter. And, you know, when they built the pub, what they did then was they put in, and the shop, put in big lamps. And these lamps were worked by...
Generators.
And there was great heat from the lamps to dry out the wood and make it look old. It'll just tell you all the trouble they went to. And some of the drivers just been sitting under the lamps all day. Some of them asleep, you know, until they be called.
I went to school in Dunquin, Dunquin National School.
This is Lish E. Helge, who played one of the school children in Ryan's Daughter.
Sometime in 68, this crowd came into the school and they said that they wanted to make a film in Dunquin and they needed some of the pupils in the school.
Are you away to the schoolhouse then?
No, Rose, I think I'll scramble up the dunes and pay me respects to my wife.
Oh, yes.
The schoolhouse was built at a separate location to the village, overlooking the ocean.
John Moorhead there, the Basket Islands.
Leash is looking at photographs in the book Troubled Epic by Michael Tanner.
Then further on is Inis Tuishkirt, which is the dead man.
The sleeping giant.
The sleeping giant.
Yeah, what's the sleeping giant?
He's a giant big creature that is friendly.
Yeah, and what does he look like now?
He looks like an island.
What are your memories of the schoolhouse when it was in its prime?
Oh, the building was beautiful. It was lovely. It was all stone on the outside, and it was whitewashed on the inside, but very dirty looking. And Robert Mitchum and Sarah Miles, they had their living quarters right beside the school room.
It was probably like any primary school in any parish, really.
This is Anya E. Leake, another child actor in the film.
There was two rooms in it. There was the desk, the normal school desk, you know, that you sat behind. It wasn't a table and chairs. There was a boys' side and a girls' side. There was two doors, like the boys and the girls. The boys went out one door, the girls, even though we sat in the same classroom. We had two different doors to go out.
And they had two different playgrounds as well?
They had. There was a kind of a divide down the middle.
And what's that thing up there, do you think?
It's a chimney.
There's a chimney, but there's no...
fireplace.
There's no fireplace.
Oh. Maybe it's just for decoration.
What do you think all that is?
Oh, that might be the bathroom.
That might be the kitchen.
No, I think it might be the bathroom.
Yeah.
Because the school was a perfect building. Everything, the walls outside, the septic tanks there, they had everything done properly.
Yeah.
And no money spared. And they had the best of builders, were all local stonemasons. And they brought young fellas in with them to be taught, and they paid the young fellas full rate. There was no half measures. A lot of those young people that were trained in the film, they're old people now and they're still working. They continued their trades.
Was it an exact replica of what schoolhouses looked like in the 1890s?
Yes, it was. It was probably better than most.
It was like an ordinary school to us. The whole school of Dunquin School was there. Bus used to come every morning, collect us, but we had to bring our school bags with us.
We were all excited, of course, you know, sort of, and the teacher, I suppose, was more concerned about how was the homework going to work out and how was she going to manage to teach the classes.
Mary Quinn in Irish, Mary Quinn in English. I was teaching the school in Dunquin during Ryan's Daughter.
All the children were Irish speaking. Did they have any English?
They were always native Irish speakers, and they understood English, and they had some little words of English, but they wouldn't be very fluent in English. Now they would understand it, and some of them were maybe better than each other.
I remember when we went to the Ryan's Daughter schoolhouse, the first thing we had to do was we had to learn Our Father Who Art in Heaven in English, because we didn't know it in English, so we had to learn it off by heart. And six times table, we had to learn that off by heart.
Six times table, yeah. They were well able, I'm telling you, in English. In English.
And Robert Mitchum was their teacher.
He was their teacher, yeah. And they were so good, they took it for granted, really, didn't they?
Filming continued for the whole year of 1969, so the children got to know some of the cast pretty well.
All right, come on now. Go on looking.
What are your memories about Robert Mitchum? Would you have looked up to him as almost like a teacher of your own?
We were very fond of him. I, you know, sort of, he just seemed to be very nice to the school children, like, you know, sort of, like when you hear about film stars, you kind of think, oh my God, they're uppity. And he seemed to come along and he would talk to us, and maybe that was part of what he had to do, like, to be comfortable with the school children.
He's like a child in this place.
Sarah Miles was lovely to us.
And I'm not a child.
We used to mind her son, Thomas, if she was filming.
What was it like being directed by David Lean? He was very famous for being a perfectionist.
Yeah, but he was a perfectionist, yes. That's why everything had to be just right. Not just half right, but right. And he would have no qualms in doing a scene maybe 5, 6, 10 times until he got it right.
Oh, yes, that's all right. Good.
Picture and...
That's good, stuff. Good, fine. Mm. Better do one more in case of some sort of cock-up. Right, one more.
In 1970, David Lean finally completed his epic, leaving the Dingle Peninsula transformed forever.
It's 50 years afterwards now, and the place still has the sign of Ryan's Daughter.
Yeah.
Ryan's Daughter was the last of the handmaids. Nothing spared. Everything was handmade. Everything that was fictional.
The village, however, was demolished after the crew left.
The village was built on a commonage. Seven or eight people had a share in the commonage, and it was getting to be... It'd be very hard to mind it, because there was a lot of people coming in and having a look and staying, and, you know, so at the end they decided to knock it. It's an awful pity, though.
But although the village was knocked down, the schoolhouse remained standing, the last remaining construction relic of Ryan's Daughter.
Well, the schoolhouse belonged to one farmer, you see, that land only belonged to the one person.
Yeah, the Ryan group bought it. They bought that schoolhouse.
Hang on, the Ryan group?
Thank you for flying Ryanair.
So now it's Ryanair's daughter.
It'll be Ryanair's daughter.
They bought that schoolhouse thinking maybe they could develop it into a holiday home or something like that. But what they didn't realise is that access to it belongs to a few people. And kind of the road was closed off then when Ryan's Daughter was finished.
Before his death, Tony Ryan, Ryanair's founder, made several attempts to get planning permission to renovate the schoolhouse.
There was talks about it being turned into a little heritage centre and mementos of Ryan's Daughter and all that. But
they came to nothing. Then, in 2015, a storm destroyed the roof.
And what does it look like now?
It looks like it's all really broken.
Where's the roof gone?
The roof is gone probably into the sea because there was a storm.
Seamus Cussie Fitzgerald. I'm a local county councillor here in the Dingle Peninsula. Well, I'd like to see the Ryan's Daughter schoolhouse restored to its former state. Obviously, the roof has gone off it at the moment, but it's only a matter of time before the walls will start to deteriorate, like with water and rain and frost and snow, etc. I'd like to see it restored to the way it was.
Is it something that you'd like to raise again with the council, well, potentially?
I'm continuously raising it, and management are well aware of my concerns and fault and are interested in the old schoolhouse. We need the goodwill of the Ryan family representatives if we want to do anything with the schoolhouse. So I hope that goodwill will come.
The Ryan family declined to tell me of their plans for the property. In a way, though, the schoolhouse was not left in a happy state at the end of Ryan's Daughter. In the story, and here's a spoiler alert, the villagers attack Rosie Ryan and her husband after they discover she's been having an affair with a British officer.
Stop him!
We were told to stay back, so we were standing on the fence because we were too small. They came up the road and they pulled her out of the house at the back of the school. And the school classroom, they pulled her out and they just cut her hair up and dragged her clothes off. And oh, it was terrible. It was awful. I was really scared that day. I was actually bawling, crying, because I thought it was free, because she looked as if they had cut her hair off and she was all scratched. Except that I saw my father standing on a stone outside the school. And I saw him and I said, oh, if anything happens, he'll be there to mind me. Even though they were acting, it looked so real to us. It was very real.
I'm at a holy site just a few metres away from the schoolhouse. It's dedicated to Saint Gobnet, the patron saint of Dunquin.
A wishing well! It's just a wishing well where people put their items if they have... If somebody has passed away, what is her name again? Goblet.
Do you think she's happy or sad?
I think she's happy in heaven.
It's a funny thing. I was down there one day with 28 Americans, and they were all faith healers. There was one woman, and she healed with her voice. And she made different sounds and everything else. And they went to the well, and they kept telling me this was a happy place. And then when they went down to the schoolhouse, they said, this is not a happy place. There is something in this area that we don't like. And the one with her voice coming away said, nothing will ever happen there. And I often think about her.
Today, the schoolhouse has been reclaimed by nature. It looks like one of the many crumbling buildings from the late 1800s in the west of Ireland. But although it's only a prop from a movie, built 1969, not 1893, its sense of history is no less impressive and no less foreboding.
And there's a haunted house right there.
You're listening to Propped Up on Documentary on News Talk.
Ryan's daughter. Perfect. Is there anything else?
Let's just see now. Oh, yes. You might be interested in this. Rawhead Rex. A nasty video from the 1980s. The monster costume. Let's just say it struck the fear of God into audiences.
This is Red Cross in County Wicklow. I'm on the hunt for a cannibalistic Celtic god last seen around these parts in 1986.
I do remember this gentleman. He was in search, perhaps, of the monster, and then the guard of cars all flew out with the horns beeping after one another.
You have people running out from there screaming that there was a monster around us, and he came out from under a big granite phallic symbol.
Rawhead Rex has not gone down in history as one of Ireland's greatest productions.
Jesus Christ! It's a bloody massacre!
I would say that the people who worked on it didn't necessarily put it on their CVs.
In fact, the horror film, which tells the story of a pagan god who unleashes a wave of terror in the Irish countryside, has long been considered an awkward footnote in Ireland's cinematic history.
Yeah, and we all knew it was pretty ridiculous.
Chief amongst complaints was the monster costume.
Shoot the bastard, son.
But was this creature design really as horrific as critics said? And what is the legacy of one of Ireland's most infamous exploitation films?
Rawhead. That's what they called him. Rawhead!
I'm from the north side of Dublin.
This is Gary Fitzpatrick, who worked in catering on Rawhead Rex.
Gary, what was the filmmaking scene like in Ireland in the mid-1980s?
Ireland always had some of the best technical crews, where in the past the Irish had always travelled over to the UK. But then money started going into Bray, and Bray started to becoming a bit of a hit on films coming into Ireland.
Rawhead Rex was one such production. In order to get under the monster's prosthetics, I travelled to London to meet the film's visual effects designers.
I'm Peter McKenzie. Listen, I was hired by the Rawhead production team to design the lead creature for the film.
And this is his former colleague, John Humphreys.
I was working in the background, casting prosthetics and mold making and doing some of the technical stuff on the film. At the time, we were working on loads and loads of TV programmes from the two Ronnies.
So it's good night from me.
And it's good night from him.
The Young Ones.
You completed that, utter bastard!
Doctor Who.
Doctor Who. You name it, we worked on loads.
They also created a fictional, futuristic TV host called Max Headroom.
This is Max Headroom.
And that was meant to be a computer-generated TV presenter. Me and Peter cheated it all with prosthetic makeup and a fiberglass jacket.
That makes it sound a little bit easy.
It wasn't easy.
Prior to working on Rawhead Rex, the pair collaborated with director George Pavlou on Underworld, an adaptation of one of Clive Barker's short stories.
Clive Barker was very much an up-and-coming writer at that stage. He certainly created his very own unique stamp on horror. I would say that the Clive Barker's writings are particularly gruesome and particularly graphic.
We'll tear your soul apart.
We got the call from George saying, we're doing another Clive Barker. Oh, great, great. The bad news is we start shooting in 3.5 weeks. Oh my God, this is, never mind 3.5 weeks, one really needs 4 or 5 months to create something like this.
My name is Maeve Patterson. I was the costume supervisor on Rawhead Rex. Consolata Boyle was the costume designer.
Do you recall the story, what the story was?
There's a farmer out in his field and he has a big stone that he unearths and moves, and it's been the burial place of this monster. The monster comes back and he seems to follow this family, two young children and a mum and dad.
Do you remember the little boy in it?
Hugh O'Connor.
I was 10. I do remember that they wouldn't send us the script. We could only read the scenes I was in, which included me getting, you know, killed by a huge monster. So I think they were afraid I might be too young to read the rest of it.
Clive Barker wrote the screenplay.
He had a very specific look for the creature's head as well. Can you tell me what that was?
So Clive's original concept and the way it's described in the book is really as a terrifying huge penis. I seem to remember it was a penis with immense teeth. The censors, I can't imagine, would have allowed it. There was no question of having him look like a penis. Some people said he did look like a bit of a penis, but that was for different reasons.
Peter and John's visual effects company redesigned the creature with help from a young artist called Paul Catling.
We emphasised the Celtic god image. We made him hugely sort of muscular. We emphasised his teeth and we had the sort of long trailing hair. We absolutely took elements from the original description by Clive Barker, but then we very much reworked it to make it feasible to build within the time. Once we had a full replica of the actor in fiberglass, the job began for Paul to sculpt the full creature in clay over the top of that cast. Literally head to toe with all the muscles, the teeth, claws. Normally a sculptor doing a piece like that would take months. Paul probably had 4 or 5 days to do it in.
Serious cursing went on in that workshop in the middle of the night, and absolute tears.
Some of the action takes place in a church interior where Ronan Wilmot plays a demented priest welcoming the return of Rawhead.
You are one of God's teachers.
God! He is God!
They were building a massive set in a huge barn outside of Bray for the church interior scenes.
This is Neil Toulon, who alongside his brother Sean created the stained glass windows in the church, which depict the monster's backstory.
There was a man dressed up in a costume, wasn't there? And then there was an animatronic head.
There were two heads, one attached to a body. It was purely, you know, for visuals. And the other was for actions, close-ups, and that was the animatronic version. It was pretty gruesome, pretty grisly, and it was, you know, probably 1.5 times or twice to scale of a human head.
So what were the eyes like, first of all, on it?
The description of the eyes was that they shimmered in a semi-hypnotic way. We ran 50 or so fibre optics into the back of each animatronic eye.
And then the teeth?
The teeth were made from acrylic the very same way and with the very same materials that dentures are made with. The jaw used to semi-dislocate and kind of stretch out.
Hugh O'Connor, 10 years old at the time of filming, recalls his introduction to Rawhead Rex.
I do remember them not wanting me to be freaked out by the monster, so they did the worst thing possible. They brought me into this room and they turned around the head, which was on like just like a wig stand, and they went, "This is the monster," and his eyes were red and he had these teeth, and I went, "Ah!" And I just was really upset, I remember. So it freaked me out, and I'm still freaked out.
Rawhead Rex was played by a German called Heinrich.
Who was a big 6'8" German guy. I think his family have a reindeer farm somewhere in Wicklow, and they got this guy to wear the suit.
He was very tall, much too big to be a man.
And when he put the suit on, he was even more empowering. I think the monster must have been 7 foot tall.
8 foot, 9 foot.
So half the battle was trying to describe to him what one actually wanted him to do through the confines of a mask. He could only
just see through the mouth. Couldn't see through the eyes and couldn't really hear, and he didn't really understand English.
Heinrich was not comfortable in Rawhead's skin.
He was constantly being got in and out of the costume because he couldn't stay in it for too long. It was extremely hot on him. And there were always seemed to be lots of people around him repairing him and sticking and gluing bits back on together.
I remember him complaining that they'd done some second unit stuff and they'd had somebody else in the suit, and he was like, someone else is sweating in my suit, which I can understand, that's grim.
Shut up! I'm trying to read my comic! What?
Like, when I remember watching it about 10 years ago, I wanted me to die because I'm so annoying in it. So it's great when I die, I'm like, yes, the kid is annoying. I do remember the big scene that we had was when I get killed. I'm reading in the car and the monster comes up and basically rips me out of the car. And I had to do the classic look up and go, ah!
One scene, however, stands out beyond all others.
There's a particularly graphic scene where Rawhead pisses on a priest.
That was after he'd torn the church apart inside, yeah.
And there was Ronan Wilmot, he was
Ronan
the priest.
Ronan Wilmot, that's right. And he dragged him outside and, yeah, peed on him. Must have been some hose that they used.
I remember this is the 80s. This isn't like last year. A lot more goes when it comes to religion than it did back then.
Holy Catholic Ireland then. Yeah, because we were very religious at that stage.
There was some awkwardness there with the crew, who were pretty horrified. Certainly with the officials of the church.
That church had been deconsecrated, I think.
Well, it was after that film.
When the film was released later in 1986, it didn't exactly clean up at the Oscars.
The Creature came in for a certain amount of criticism, some of which was fair, some of which definitely wasn't. People don't care whether something's low budget or whether it's medium or high budget. They're going to judge it against the other films of its time. And there were some pretty good creature films being made at that time. And so some of Rawhead looked quite clunky and B-filmish.
Clive Barker felt particularly aggrieved in one interview describing the monster as Miss Piggy in combats.
I thought it was completely unnecessary and uncalled for Clive Barker to attack our work.
It didn't have any piggy qualities about it at all.
Despite Rawhead Rex's toxic reputation following its release, many people involved went on to stellar careers. Paul Catling, who helped design the costume, has
gone on to become one of the foremost creature conceptualists,
working on Harry Potter films, Star Wars, Marvel superhero movies.
Every other production, his name pops up.
Maeve Patterson has forged a long career in the industry. Consolata Boyle, who worked with her on Rawhead Rex, has been nominated for 3 Academy Awards. Hugh O'Connor is now an established actor and photographer. He recently directed his first feature film.
It's called Metal Heart.
Max Headroom, Peter and John's other creation, became one of the biggest pop culture phenomenons of the 1980s.
But then it snowballed. But I do remember that it was on hoardings everywhere, all over the place.
Yes, and certainly when I first went to Hollywood, and literally every hoarding was Max Headroom. We couldn't believe it. It's like, oh, there's our work. Oh, there it is again. And there it is again. And it was literally all the way down.
Max Headroom. I mean, I'm just a normal, modest, humble, self-effacing, well, let's say, superstar.
For Peter Litton, Rawhead Rex marked a huge turning point in his life.
One of the lasting memories for myself of Rawhead Rex is nothing to do with the film. I met my lifelong partner, and he was the caterer on the film.
Remember Gary Fitzpatrick, who I spoke to earlier?
Met Peter in Wicklow. Came over, stayed in London, and have been here ever since.
So really, something amazing came out of this film, which you probably didn't expect when you went over to Ireland.
It certainly changed both our lives. Not only are we life partners, we went on to set up companies and businesses together. We produced films together. The best thing I ever did came out of Wicklow in the middle of winter shooting Rawhead.
For some, they'd say that another horror came out of Ireland, but that could have been me.
That was a good line to end on.
There you go. I fed you the good one.
Over the years, something really unusual happened. Rawhead Rex began to be shown at horror film festivals around the world. People created imitation models of the costume, and a bemused Clive Barker began signing them. A special edition Blu-ray of the film was recently released to positive reviews. Rawhead Rex might not be the terrifying spectre the filmmakers intended to create, but it's a hell of a lot of fun.
Does it bother you that people watch this film with a sense of fun rather than a sense of fear?
Not at all. Absolutely not at all. Listen, I've directed three or four appalling, truly appalling horror films in the past, and I look back on them with great affection. You can celebrate that awfulness and kind of go with it.
What was achievable with the budget we had was a very successful film. And now it's a cult classic, it deserves to be there.
They thought he'd die, you see. Thought they could forget about him. But the Dark Ones come back. They always do.
You're listening to Propped Up on Documentary on News Talk.
Rawhead Rex, I think you'll appreciate that one.
Okay, so that's Ryan's Daughter from the 1970s, Rawhead Rex from the 1980s. How about an Irish film from the 1990s, something in which props played a really important role?
Okay. Oh, I've just the film for you. Roddy Doyle's The Van.
We're standing in the dunes in Dollymount. The beautiful sunset is just fading in the background, and you can see Poolbeg, the two towers in Poolbeg, and the van with the lights on inside of the van. It's gorgeous. I was 18. It was the summer of 95 and it was scorching out.
Design and props usually play peripheral parts in films, but in The Van, an adaptation of Roddy Doyle's novel, the chip van was far more than just window dressing.
It was a character, it was like a cast member. The van was a cast member.
The Van tells the story of Bimbo, played by Donal O'Kelly, a man laid off from his job.
I was let go.
What?
Let go, made redundant.
Bimbo invests in a chip van and his best friend Larry, played by Colm Meaney, joins him in the business.
The two guys were in a midlife crisis.
This is production designer Mark Geraghty. After working on The Commitments and The Snapper, he was hired in 1995 to work on the final part of Roddy Doyle's Barrytown trilogy.
The van represented hope. It represented a way out. Independence. Their morale was way down. This was it. This was going to change their whole life. They were going to be businessmen. They were going to be successful. You know, they could afford to pay for their own pint. And that's important for a man, you know, especially back then. And they could stand up high. Yep, there we go. Yeah, we're the men.
The Van is set in a fictional district of Dublin, based on Kilbarrack, the north side suburb where Roddy Doyle grew up.
It is a very unique area.
This is Nellie Conroy, who plays Larry's daughter, Diane. She's lived in Kilbarrack most her life.
Like, I moved out here when I was about 8, and once I moved out here, you discovered loads of young people and loads of fields, and all of a sudden you were like, freedom, you know?
Nellie and I are in the Foxhound Inn in Kilbarrack, where some of the film was shot.
Yeah, a free drink here, because I was drinking Guinness at the time.
Every time they done a shot.
Every time they do a retake,
just have to fill it back up to the sack.
Did you get that job every day of the week?
Oh, every day. Looking for it now. You're looking for an extra in there.
Roddy Doyle had been a teacher in the local area.
He taught in Greendale, so everyone knows Roddy around here because a lot of them were taught by him.
Including production designer Mark Geraghty.
Roddy was my English teacher in Greendale, so I went to Greendale. So, I mean, look, this was a story in my backyard. So I knew, you know, I knew what it should be, everything it should be, and having known Roddy, and in a way, maybe, gosh, I was very close to it, so, you know, you've got to sort of separate yourself from it and do your job.
With Stephen Frears on board as director and with Roddy Doyle producing, Mark's first task was to find a van.
You know, we didn't have computers then, so you went into newspapers, see what's been advertised, car magazines. We drove around Dublin looking at all these chip vans and what they should look like. And of course we can make them, but, you know, we said, where's the one, where's the one? And nothing hit us at all. And I remember we were in Transit House at Sir John Rogerson's Quay. That was our production office, and I was walking around for lunch. I passed an unpussed yard, and right in the back corner, there seemed to be this like overgrown, poor little van in the corner, unpussed van, and it was on its knees. And I fell in love with it and go, this needs a new home. It was like a character. It had a face. And I went, this is it. And I ran back to the production office and I grabbed Stephen Frears. I said, I found it, come around the corner. And we both stood there and he goes, yes, 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 yes.
Oi. He's busy.
What does it look like?
Come on, I want to show you something.
What? Now, the first time we see the van in the narrative, it's when Brendan O'Connor introduces it to the characters.
In the back garden.
And it looks like shite.
Yes. Yes. And in a way, you know, it looked like that when we found it. But, you know, in certain ways. And we put it in the back garden in Kilbarrick and we covered it in pigeon shit. Yeah. We really did, you know. And again, you could see, I think they felt what I felt when I saw it in the yard. Potential. This is it. This is going to make the movie. And they're like, this is going to make our lives.
That's the state of the van when they found it. Pretty bad, isn't it? Look at the state of it. The absolute state of it. Like.
As for inside the van.
It's like the inside of a leper.
What did you fill it with?
Basically, it was old equipment we found that was disused. The prop people were down and they found all this disused. And then we melted wax and candle. We just covered it in dirt.
In the film, the van is brought back to Bimbo's home for rehabilitation.
And so this is when the van was coming in and they had all the people following the van and doing the cartwheels and all.
Everyone knew the story in Kilbarrick, and the people in Kilbarrick were fantastic. And when we brought the van in wrecked like that down to the house, they knew what was happening. What colour are you going to paint it? You know, it's all that everyone knew.
At the time, Colin Meaney, who plays Larry, was famous for his role in Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
But there was a huge crowd of kids the first day we were filming Kilbarrick, and Colin was there, and, you know, Colin was pretty famous. And Colin, you know, they were all going, Colin. He's like that, and waving back to the kids, and all the kids in unison shout, beam me up, you bollocks! Yeah. He's just dropped. Great Dublin sense of humour.
In the narrative, they start doing up the van. Did that almost echo what was going on behind the scenes as well?
Yeah, absolutely. You had to love this van. It couldn't be offensive in any way, you know. So, first of all, I picked some very warm colours. It's a butter colour. It's a very warm colour that'll make you feel well. The cream on it, it's not just cream. It's a very warm in temperature cream. And then the happy red. And it also helped us to pick it out in wide shots from everywhere. And there was a happy red too. So everything about this van was nice.
And painted on the van?
Bimbo's Burgers takeaway. Mind that snapper, it says at the back. This has the lovely fresh fish and the picture of the fish and the burger.
The burger looks like a fucking sausage. Shut up, lady, will you?
Yes, and it had a great, brilliant, isn't it? And it had fantastic. And it had a great homespun feel to it, you know. And care. Today's chips today.
On the front bumper, there was a mascot for the Irish football team.
And, you know, it's like you see big truckers have teddy bears on it and stuff like that. So we stuck a teddy bear with an Irish wig on it.
In the story, Larry and Bimbo start to make money out of the van with help from Diane and her brother, played by Nellie's real-life brother, Rory Conroy.
The van, so you just went in the back door and there was a hatch, there was a countertop, and then the hatch that you put up where you'd serve the customers.
Right, queue up for your chipses.
And then there was little shelves up above, and then behind on your right there was the fryer and stuff like that, and all the chips off the bags and the salt and vinegar and all. Yeah,
we actually bought the inside of a real chip van. We designed it as to exactly how a chip van would work. This is here, this is here, this is here, and the till is there, you know. And you could make chips in it, you could make burgers in it, and you could sell drinks from it. It's exactly, you know, it worked. Nothing different about it than to a working van.
So the van itself was a film set.
It was
as
a
well
film set. Yeah, sides came off, you know, everything for lighting, and there was, you know, little hatches in it for camera traps. But God, it was a small space to work in.
Jesus, all we want to do is make a few shit.
I was in the Dockers pub with Colm having a pint one evening. We were talking about how like the vows, and you know, it was really struggled to be in there in the heat and everything. It was a hot summer. But he said he loved it because it felt more real than a film set. And he reckons he lost about 2 stone on the gig. And inside that was sweltering when the chips were going and everything. I remember the prop girl, Nuala, she's making the chips and Roddy passed by and she said, "Roddy, will you do me a favour and write a bloody story about the famine? Because if I ever see another potato again, I'll deck you with it."
Where's the hatch?
The hatch works in this incredible way of framing the actors.
Deliberately. Absolutely deliberately. We called it chipovision. We did it the ratio of widescreen. 2:35:1, whatever. And it's actually chiposcope.
Like a puppet show or something.
Punch and Judy, yeah.
We are coming up to the roundabout at the end of the bull wall. And the sun is splitting the stones and the dunes are in front of us.
Some of the film was shot at Dollymount, a seaside suburb of Dublin, a few miles away from Kilbarrack.
And whereabouts was the van parked?
I think it was over here to the left in the dunes. It was kind of in the dunes. But the dunes change all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. So they might be the same as they were in 95.
In one scene filmed here, Diane is serving food from the van, her infant child beside her, when a character played by Ronan Wilmot, remember him from Rawhead Rex, finds an unfortunate ingredient in his food.
It's not fish.
What is it?
It's white.
It's a nappy!
He's found the nappy in his batter. Ronan Wilmot is on the bike chasing after us. Colm's character goes to throw the can and all at him out the door, the back door.
Yeah. You'll kill him!
What?
And then Donal's driving in a panic. It was all very panicked, holding a real child. And you're kind of standing up in the back of a van.
In one gorgeous sequence, Larry, Bimbo and Diane drive home from Dollymount singing an old Lee Marvin song.
And I don't sing. They said, "You have to sing." I was like, "Oh God," so I just had to go for it.
I was born under a wandering star.
Dollymount Strand is also where the story ends, and here's another spoiler alert. Bimbo, frustrated with Larry's meddling, decides to destroy the van.
Ah, the poor van goes off to sea then, when they drive it into the sea.
One of the last things we shot, so we had 3 vans. So I said, "Look, let's put one in, let the tide come in and come out and see what, you know, it actually looks like." So we left it there, and that Monday night there was an almighty storm. We went back down on the Tuesday morning that we're supposed to be filming on. The van was like a little, the size of a suitcase. It crushed it. It absolutely crushed it. And this couldn't be the end of the movie, you know. So I knew I had 2 more. And, you know, I stood there with Stephen and I said, "Do you know something? We don't want people to remember the van in any way wrecked. Why don't we just put it in and leave it on the beach as a lonely, you know, waiting for someone else to come and take it?"
For the characters in the movie, and indeed the people involved in making the film, this 4-wheeled prop meant so much more than just a chip van.
There's a line towards the end of the film, and again, it's not something you normally hear someone talking about the background in this manner, but he said,
"I'm going to kill it. I'm going to kill the poxy van."
So at that stage, it's like an interloper.
It absolutely. Look what the van did to them. Metaphorically, it got into their inner souls and brought everything out, brought their anger out. But it tested every emotion.
Do you know what became of the van?
No, do you?
No.
Mark will know.
There was a lovely thought that we'd get the cast to drive up to the Cannes Film Festival in the van. And we kept it for a year, but it never came off. The expectations we had for the movie were really, really high, and it didn't really get that, you know, that big release we thought it deserved. So we never got the van to Cannes.
So what became of the van?
The van at the end, the mechanic who did it, Robbie, he defunctioned it.
So the van was killed?
The van was killed.
The van might be dead, but it has lived on in the hearts of the locals in Kilbarrack.
Still there, yeah. Of course it is. Every time you see it, it's still there. Regardless how old it is. Great. It was great, great crack. It was brilliant.
complete sense of ownership people of Kilbarrick have, and that's our film. He'll never take it away from them. It's them. It was written about them. You know, it was observed. It's their life. Roddy's one of the great observers of life. And it's as much theirs as it is his.
The idea of friendship, community,
yes.
And not letting outside forces tear you apart.
No, absolutely, absolutely. It's back to their values, not material things. You know, friendship is more important than anything. And family is more important than anyone. And you sometimes have to have an intruder to remind you of that.
The van is very precious. I was very lucky to be in it, and I was very lucky to get the opportunity to do one of Roddy Doyle's films. You could really see the humour of the people from the north side, and to show these areas with so much love.
Lads, thanks a million. Yeah, appreciate that.
Thank you. Cheers,
thank you.
Thanks very much for all of these. What did you say your shop was called again?
Rose Videos.
Rose, as in?
Ronan. Ronan Wilmot.
God! He is God! It's a nappy!
Propped Up was produced and presented by Pavel Barter. The programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee. To listen back to this or any other News Talk documentary, go to newstalk.com/documentary on News Talk.